17th lecture of our current season. Our speaker this evening is Dr. Charles McDowell, who is the professor in chemistry and head of the Department of Chemistry at our university. He was born in Belfast and he received his education in Ireland. He's a graduate of Queen's University in Belfast, where he received his Bachelor of Science degree and his Master's degree and his Doctor of Science degree. He's a scholar of distinction and holds a number of academic awards. And in 1956, he was appointed a fellow of the Royal Institute of Chemistry. He's taught at a number of universities, including Liverpool and Laval and Princeton University. And he was, for a while, a consultant on chemical warfare with the Ministry of Supply in the United Kingdom. Since coming to our campus here, he's earned a reputation for the high standard not only of his work, but of the work of his department. Tonight, he will speak on the subject of chemistry and your future. Dr. McDowell.
Well, Mr. Chairman, ladies and gentlemen, I agreed to give this talk some long, long while ago, and Mr. Metz suggested one or two topics. However, last summer intervened, and finally I received this program and found I was down to talk about chemistry and your future. This is the sort of notice that our good friend Colonel McLean puts up for chemistry graduates. And I'm pleased tonight to tell you that none of those young men and women will be in any way misled by my title, because they very cunningly, or by excellent design, arranged to have a party tonight at another place, so they're luckily of some other interest. I can rather gather that what I'm supposed to do is to talk a little bit about chemistry and what effect it might have on us in the future and what might in fact be the future of chemistry. Now, this involves a certain amount of clairvoyance and an attempt to see things as they might be perhaps the next 25 years, next 50 years, and perhaps even next 100 years. And of course, chemistry being a very rapidly advancing science, the number of scientific publications seems to go up by leaps and bounds, not only every year, but practically every hour. We've been just recently fortunate to have several organizations that have produced journals which abstract the titles, and the number of these now runs to something like 4,000 or 5,000 titles per month, and the chemists are supposed somehow or other to keep up to date by reading all these papers of which these are the titles. So you can realize that in such a vast amount of information, there are liable to be at any time discoveries or twists of fate that are likely to affect us very markedly. Now, I, apart from the various other things that Mr. Metz mentioned, I'm also noted in this campus for my modesty, and so I wouldn't dare to try to predict too many things about chemistry in the future. But what I thought I might do is to discuss some of the things which have been happening very, very recently at chemistry. And tonight I'm going to discuss some of the things which have been more or less pointers in the last 5 years, some of them in the last 2 years, and some even in the last couple of weeks. These are just selected as things which seem might interest you and certainly interest us as chemists as areas from which we might expect there to be very startling discoveries and changes that will affect not only the science of chemistry but us in our everyday lives. So I'm going to deal with this subject by discussing three or four main areas, and as it is very difficult to be a very good clairvoyant, those of you who follow the horses or involve in bingo or any of these things know how difficult it is to predict even one move ahead the next few seconds. As it's so difficult to do that sort of thing, I'm going to try and lay before you some of the basis on which these discoveries have advanced to perhaps let you for a little while enter into the spirit of these discoveries to try and show you the trends which are going on, and then I'm going to be rash to suggest one or two things that might happen in the future that might affect it. And I think in this way we'll have an entertaining evening and perhaps be able to make a few speculations which won't be too far off. I think that we'll find perhaps in the next 25 years or so that at least one of them has been successful. Now, first of all, I have to say this, that chemistry as a subject has really changed enormously in the last 25 years. It used to be a sort of smells and stinks type of subject, but it's been one which has gained a great deal by the application of discoveries in physics and also in quantum theory, which is a mathematical way of dealing with properties of molecules. And so chemistry today has achieved a rate of development due to the introduction of a number of very startling new techniques which have increased the sphere of chemistry greatly and had made tremendous changes in the whole range of phenomena which we now can study. Now, one of these big areas which I'm going to discuss has been the development of what we know as polymers or synthetic resins. About 30 years ago, when a chemist was studying any of his little reactions and got a non-crystalline solid or some sticky liquid, he tended to throw it in the bin and forget about it. But around about 30 years ago, chemists began to take this whole phenomenon of manufacture and study of polymeric substances very seriously. And out of those, of course, as you know, have arisen a great number of practical things which are of interest to us, things like these nylon stockings and all on clothing that we all wear and various plastic materials. But that isn't the real interest of the chemist. The chemist is really interested in why these materials behave as they do. Now, it became clear during the last 20 years as to how one could cause certain types of chemical substances to join together to form materials which would have the properties of plastics. And the main manifestation which was needed was to cause small molecules to combine together by some means or other so that they would form a very long chain molecule, or a molecule of very high molecular weight, as we call it. These molecules we now call macromolecules, large molecules. It has been found that they are extremely important, not only for the utilitarian purpose of providing plastics, but as we'll see a little later, extremely important from the point of view of the properties of these molecules in biology and in controlling our daily existence. Now, one recent startling piece of work which has been done in the field of polymers has been the discovery of how to make polymers in a way which no one had thought was possible. Let me say that when one is making a polymer molecule, say like nylon, there are two chemical substances, we call them A and B, allowed to combine together to form a very long chain so that there may be something like 100,000 of each of these things joined together in one big long chain. Now you can realize that it would be seemingly impossible to cause these to combine together in any other than a random fashion. That is, one would hardly expect to be able to control the way in which these would combine. And in fact, that's normally the case. Certainly one would never expect to be able to cause these long molecules to take any particular shape. But during the last 5 or 10 years, just this sort of thing has, in fact, been found possible how to do this. And so there's been arisen the study and the discovery of the way to make what we call crystalline polymers or oriented polymers, or more scientific term is stereospecific polymers. Now, one other discovery has been not only the making of these, but a way in which to cause these molecules to join together so that you get something like this, A, all the A's joining together, and then all the B's joining together, and then another lot of A's, and then another lot of B's. And it's been possible to cause this type of phenomena by a number of different ways. This is what's known as the formation of block polymers. Now, we shall see later that the discovery of the method to make these block polymers has considerable importance because it's been found, just within the last 5 years really, that proteins, which of course are terribly important in all of biology and life, do in fact sometimes consist of links and groups of molecules rather like block polymers. So the fundamental discovery, importance of this discovery, is really far-reaching. Well now, if we could have the first slide, I should add that I'm going to show three groups of slides to illustrate the ways in which these discoveries have been made and then to go on to suggest something about what they might mean in each of these groups in the future. So if I could have the first slide, please. Now, this... I don't seem to have a pointer here, but... At the top, this is a representation of a polymer molecule, and you see it consists of carbon atoms joined together, and this will go on for perhaps several hundred thousands of links. And in this particular one, the groups X, X, and H, the ones which are heavy are pointing out towards us, so they are what we call oriented in a certain direction. You'll see that there's a randomness. There are two X's and then one H. That's normally the case in polymerization. We can't usually control the way in which these chemical bonds are distributed in space. If I might have the next slide, please. Now, in this particular one here, you see, all these little groups which are, have a heavy shading with C6H5 on them, they're phenyl groups, and they're all sticking out towards me, or towards you. And the hydrogen atoms are all sticking, pointing in towards the back of the screen. Now, those are all oriented in the same direction. And that type of polymer we call an isotactic polymer, and that sort of polymer is crystallizable. Now, you might say, well, this is a very simple distinction. Why is it important? Well, the importance is this, that polymers of this type, which are isotactic, have got enormously greater strength than the ones which are randomly distributed. And so these then lead us to new polymeric materials which have got beneficial properties. For example, the ordinary polythene which you buy in the form of a washing up basin or any other type of implement of that sort is made from a random polymerized form of this substance here called ethylene. If, however, we cause it to polymerize by what's called the Ziegler process, Ziegler catalyst, into this type of thing, with all the molecules oriented, it turns out that that particular form of polyethylene has got a tensile strength approaching that of steel. And so it's got, therefore, a great advantage over ordinary polyethylene. May I have the next slide, please? Yes. Now, the ways these discoveries are due mainly to two people, but of course, as always, there are a lot of other people who have worked in the area. But the two names which should be mentioned are Professor Ziegler in Germany and Professor Natta in Italy. Natta was perhaps the first to recognize the nature of the properties of the polymer, knew that they had this particular stereochemical arrangement. But Ziegler was more the chemist, and he found out how to make these things. And his process is a very important one. It's also made Ziegler a very rich man, which of course not to be passed over. The method by which it happens is also one which may have quite an important chemistry, as we'll see in about 5 minutes' time, when it comes to the question of causing molecules to join together to form proteins. This is supposed to be a catalyst. The original molecule, which we call a monomer, some or other comes into contact with it and then grows at this point here. So we tend to get them all growing in the same way. This HCH3, 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 HCH3. That's just a very crude representation of it. Ziegler catalyst causing these stereospecific polymers to be formed. May I have the next slide, please? Now, this is another way of doing it, is to mix the monomeric material, in this case butadiene, with the lithium and you get a heterogeneous polymerization. The point I want to mention is this bit here. You see, because of the way these chemicals react, we get this type of orientation. They just don't go in anyway. They go in a preferred direction, and the next one will go on here and so forth. Now, there's another method which has just recently been discovered. Here in the next slide. This is a discovery which I just want to mention to you because it happened to be something which a young fourth year student was doing some work also in our laboratory, and he was able to make the discovery and someone else did, and it's going to be very important, so that's the luck of the game. There is known a compound called urea, and this substance will form a mixed a crystal with other compounds, so that the urea, as it were, forms rather a tube, rather like a bamboo tube, and the chemical compound gets located down the middle of this bamboo rod. These things are called clathrates. Now this is to represent this type of thing, clathrates or adducts. This is the urea channel here, and here we have butadiene inside this channel. Now because of the molecular dimensions here, these molecules can only sit in a certain way. They're stacked like pennies, but they can't orient and move about too much. They're restricted. If one now causes these to join up, they can only join up across here, you see, so you end up with this oriented polymer. And in fact, this has been done by Dr. Brown at the General Electric Laboratories. He took this sort of substance, irradiated it with high-energy electron beam, and then these molecules all join up in the oriented form. The urea can then be dissolved off in water and leave you with the oriented polymer. This has become a very important method for making these. I think that's the... Could I just see the next slide, please? And then, yes, thank you. Well, now, that's the way these discoveries have been made, and most of these things have actually occurred during the last year or two. Dr. Brown's paper only appeared a few months ago. So now we've reached this stage of making these polymeric materials which have got these important properties. What now of the future? Well, it's not difficult to predict this because I read in the Observer the other day that the ICI company in England have actually claimed that they're going to put on the market a polypropylene which you're going to be able to put water in. It has all the properties of the polythene beakers and cups you know, and be able to put it on your electric stove and switch it on and boil the water in it. Think of this sort of thing. Now, this is a rather mundane sort of example, but it does illustrate the type of thing that these new polymers will lead to. The other type of thing that's easy to predict is that in the continued increase in the use of this type of new polymeric material in construction, you can... All of you see around you today the tremendous impact that polymeric materials have in our daily lives, in the making of pieces of furniture and also various bits of home equipment. It's easy to extrapolate this and say that if we can have polymeric materials which can be easily fabricated and manufactured, and they're going to have roughly the tensile strength of steel, well, it doesn't take much imagination to say that they're going to play an important part in construction, because you will be able to have all the tremendous advantages of factory production of parts of houses, and then they'll be brought along to University Hill here and just screwed up with a few plastic screws and you'll have a home in a very short time. Now, it doesn't take much imagination to say this will happen in the next 25 years. I myself will think a great deal of this will happen in the next 10 years. And so one can go on to extrapolate that type of thing. There are, however, other interesting things to say. Not only have chemists been active in this area of polymerization, they've also been active in other types of areas where they're polymerizing inorganic compounds and preparing materials which have tremendous high temperature properties and are resistant to corrosion, and so it's easy to see that these things are going to have a tremendous effect on our lives too. Well, that's just one of the easy things to predict. Let's now move on to another area. Now, in nature, we have a great number of polymeric materials, and the ones I want to discuss tonight are the proteins and related substances, because I think that it's going to be easy again for me to say that they're going to, that the study of these materials and what we've learned from them recently is certainly going to have an enormous effect on us in the very near future and certainly in the distant future. Well, I think the best thing is for me just to say this, that that proteins consist of simple chemical compounds joined together to form macromolecules. The simple compounds from which they are made are called amino acids. These are things like acetic acid, which we all know, except they contain a nitrogen and hydrogen and sometimes a sulfur atom in them. And they're usually quite simple molecules. However, nature has found a way, which we'll, I hope, try to indicate to you later how nature does this, of causing these to join together to form very large macromolecules, sometimes with what we call a molecular weight of a million. That would mean that there'd be something like 100,000 of these simple amino acid units joined together to form one of these proteins. Now, since it was known that this was a type of chemical nature of proteins, obviously chemists and biophysicists became very interested to discover the intimate details of these proteins. And within the last 10 years, considerable advances have been made. These advances have gone on at the same time as the advances in polymer chemistry, and there's a certain carryover of the information from the polymer area to the protein area. They are, to chemists, macromolecules. They're large, large, very large molecules, and obviously the techniques which one develops for one can, by and large, be applied to others. And this is so often the case in science that one area never advances in isolation. It's like John Donne's famous line, "No man is an island unto himself." We soon learn that advances in another area affect us, and we're able to take them over and modify them and then make advances in our own field. Now, if I can just run quickly through these next few slides, I'll try to show you the truth of this, that these substances are very akin in their physical-chemical nature to the polymers we've been discussing. And then I'll go on to discuss one or two new properties that have been discovered recently and suggest one or two things that might affect us in the future. Now, may I have the first slide, please? The one you just had on, please. This is a representation of a protein molecule, and you can see that it does consist of a whole series of atoms joined together to form a long chain, a macromolecule. So just as we had seen in the form of the polymers. Now, for a long while it was unknown as to just how this chain continued. But about 10 years ago, Professor Polling at Caltech suggested that the protein molecule would be formed in a sort of a coil, like this, a helical coil. Here's a representation of the sort of thing here, going up and round and up and round. Now, the reason for suggesting that was this, that was 1951, just exactly 10 years ago. The reason for that is that when chemical bonds are formed, they are formed with the atoms related to each other in a very specific way. For example, you can see it here. This nitrogen, this N stands for nitrogen, this stands for carbon. Now, in these molecules, the carbon has usually four bonds, and they are distributed in space in a very special way. There is an angle between them, which is usually fairly well-defined. And so this restricts the ways in which the successive atoms can be joined on. And when one follows this through, it so happens that if you make a model of this type of thing, you are forced, because of the nature of the way the chemical bonds form together, to go in a helix of this sort. There are other special types of bonds called hydrogen bonds, which are dotted in here, which form between residual molecules containing oxygen or nitrogen and hydrogen, and they tend to hold this sort of structure close together. Now, we know, of course, today that this formula of Pauling's isn't quite correct, but the idea is a very good one, and it has been used. Can I have the next slide, please? Used by Crick and Watson and others, Crick and Watson here, to suggest how proteins and other substances which are related to them, the nucleic acids. Nucleic acids are very important to us as chemists and also important to us as human beings because they are the substances, chemical substances which control our heredity. And I'll show you this in a few moments in a very simple way. These nucleic acids are made up from polymers containing sugar units, glucose units, and various things which we call nucleotides. And these are joined together in the same sort of fashion through phosphoric acid, like this, as we have indicated before, forming a very long polymer. Now, again, this is just a two-dimensional representation. And from what I said about the nature of chemical bonds, you could easily suggest to yourself that this would be forming a three-dimensional structure in space, perhaps similar to the alpha helix that Pauling has put forward. And if we can have the next slide, please. This is just to show the extension of this in space. You have a sugar, pyrimidine base, phosphate, and so on, going on for perhaps 10 or 100,000 units, forming this substance here. There's oxyribonucleic acid, which is a very important substance, if you call it DNA. Now, I'd like to make one point here, because we'll come back to it in a few moments. There are possibly, not an infinite number, but a very large number of desoxyribonucleic acids. The reason being this, that if we interchange any of these, this may be a base we call B1, this may be a base we call B2, this may be B3. If they are arranged B1, B2, and B3, that is one DNA acid. If it's arranged B2, B3, B1, that's a different one. And so you can imagine quite easily that if you have a vast number of these units forming this macromolecule, and you can interchange these, that you can get almost an infinite number of DNA acids. And the reason this is important to appreciate is that our heredity is tied up with a particular type of one. The reason I'm a man is because I've got a particular type of form of this desoxyribonucleic acid in my cells. The reason a banana fly is a banana fly is because it's got a different form. But they're all basically made up in the same way, but they've got different arrangements of these. Some of them have different types of sugars. So when I say DNA or desoxyribonucleic acid, do keep in mind I'm only using this as a generic name for this type of polymer. Could we have the next slide, please? Well, this shows the diagram of the sort of helix, you see, the same type of thing as we had before. The next one, please. Now, I'm sure there's something that I've bought here. Could I give the next slide, please, and then I think hold on to that, put that aside, please. So if you put that aside, now put that aside also, and then let me have the next one. Which one? I'm sorry, it's my fault. Yes, here's a representation of how these may be built up. I'm afraid there's one slide left dark. Could I have the next one, please? I'll switch it off. Oh, I'm sorry, it's gone. Right on us here. Just let it go for a moment now. Yes, there's one slide been misled, but to get back to these desoxyribonucleic acid. This substance, the function of this in the body is now thought to control the synthesis of proteins within us, and when we have different desoxyribonucleic acids, we get different proteins formed in different animals. The nature of these speculations has been confirmed recently because of tremendous developments in X-ray crystallography. Until quite recently, X-ray crystallographers could only deal with very small, well-defined molecules. But because of great developments in the technique in the last 10 or 15 years, it's been possible to apply this method, which can be used to tell us the precise positions of atoms and molecules, and to apply it to very large molecules, to in fact to proteins. And if I could have those slides showing the electron densities, these are some pictures taken from some very recent work done at Cambridge, England, by Dr. Perutz and his group, where they have used electron X-ray diffraction to determine the positions of the atoms in hemoglobin molecules. This is hemoglobin from a seal. A hemoglobin, as you know, is a coloring matter, red coloring matter of blood, and it is a protein substance. It has one molecule attached on a large protein. And blood from different animals, different bloods differ because of the different types of proteins that there are formed in the animal and synthesized by the particular desoxyribonucleic acid in the animal. And the great development here has been that these don't mean anything to you, and they certainly don't mean very much to me. I'm not an X-ray crystallographer. But one can find these positions of the atoms here and use these things to show the way in which the molecule is lying in what we call the unit cell. That is this thin line run here, which is the smallest unit that repeats the whole of the large molecule. And if I could have the next one, please. This is another one from another angle. And the next slide, please. That's right. Now, this interpretation is that this here represents a crude model of the shape of a very, very large protein molecule.
I want to mention, one is a very simple one. You all know that a positive charged particle will move towards a negatively charged electrode. And when this is done in solution with chemical substances, it is a phenomenon known as electrophoresis, the movement of particles towards different electrodes. Now that technique's been used to study the properties of proteins, and it's been shown that one can distinguish one type of protein from another by the rate at which they move from one electrode towards another. The other technique, which is very important, is a very simple one. And this is the sort of thing which happens all the time to us, and we never notice it. And then someday someone notices, and it becomes an enormous discovery. I'm sure there's not a single person in this room who has not at one time or another taken a sheet of blotting paper and dried a pen on it. And notice that where the ink is on the blotting paper, there's a large blue or black mark, depending on the color of the ink. But usually surrounding it, there are semicircular rings getting less and less and less intense. Well, now, the reason that happens is that the ink material is not what we call homogeneous. It consists of a great number of different dyes, and these different shaded rings that go out from the dot are due to the migration of the dye materials out. Now that is the basis of what we call paper chromatography. In this technique, we take just ordinary blotting paper or specially prepared blotting papers and hold it in a vessel like this and spot onto it some mixture of chemicals. And then we allow a solvent such as butyl alcohol or benzene or something to flow over it and cause these materials to flow out more rapidly than they would do on our blotting paper from the ink. And we usually get a whole series of spots right all over this. We are then able to find out what these spots are by doing very sensitive chemical tests on them. Now this technique's been used to find out if these large protein molecules are in fact made up from what we said they are, namely amino acids. And it's been done in this way. There are substances called enzymes which will break up these big molecules into smaller ones, and they can be caused to break them up into quite tiny ones, into the ultimate units. And when this is done in collaboration with this technique of chromatography, we can then get what we call the amino acid sequence. We can find out which amino acids lie in a certain order along this chain. And this was done First of all, by a man called Sanger in Cambridge, in detail for the insulin molecule, which is a very important substance, as you know, which controls diabetes in mankind. And just recently, if I may have this slide, this is a very startling piece of work which has just come out. This enormous molecule here, it's the enzyme derived from ribonucleic acid. It's the bovine ribonuclease. It's an enzyme material which, in the animal, breaks up large proteins into small ones and allows the animal to digest and utilize them. Now, this substance has a molecular weight of 15,000. And Dr. Scott in the States worked out the exact sequence of all these, each one of these, histamine, methionine, glutamine, alanine, serine, all these are different substances, plotted this out completely. So we now know the exact order of these in the substance. This is a tremendously important piece of work. It's absolutely remarkable that anyone can do this. Could I have the next slide, please? But what is more important, I've mentioned this ribonucleic acid. These substances and the enzymes control in a very intimate fashion a lot of our activities. There's one of these called ACTH. It's really a hormone, and I'll talk about hormones later on, but I want to mention this substance here. This substance controls the action of our adrenaline glands, which controls my blood pressure and your good behavior. And it's always been a big problem as to control diseases due to adrenaline, and you probably all know about cortisone, which is a recent drug which does, in fact, help people with rheumatic fever and other types of diseases. Well, just on January the 20th, that's only a month ago, there appeared this paper where Dr. Hoffman at Pittsburgh and some colleagues were able to synthesize this molecule here, which contains 23 of these amino acids all joined together in the correct sequence, so this substance has got 90% of the activity of the natural hormone. And this is a tremendous piece of work because it's obvious that within the next, perhaps even now, someone has gone the whole way and prepared this synthetic hormone. This opens up great possibilities of understanding the function of the cortex of the adrenaline, which is a very important thing in the whole of pharmacology and medicine and therapeutics. May I have the next slide, please? Well, I want just to mention here, so this is the way in which these proteins are synthesized. There's the desoxyribonucleic acid here, and it causes the various small amino acids which are digested to come in and builds up these long chains of proteins and so forth. May I have the next one, please? Next slide, please. Thank you. Well, I mentioned that the synthesis of these proteins is controlled by the DNA, desoxyribonucleic acids. And you could easily see, therefore, that, as I said, there were many of these, you get many different types of proteins. Well, just within the last few years, it's been realized that this is all very important to us, because within that time, there's been discovered the fact that all of we people do not have the same type of blood in our veins. Now, this seemed obvious to some of us for a long while. There are so-called blue-blooded people and others, there are hot-blooded people and cold-blooded people. But in general, most of us have thought that the hemoglobin in our blood was all the same. But it turns out now there are several different types of hemoglobins. In fact, they got up to about 8 or 9 types. There was a new one just discovered last week. But the ones I want to mention very briefly are 3. Hemoglobin A, which is a normal one, it appears in, it's called normal because most people have it. Then there's hemoglobin S, which is present in the blood cells of people suffering from a disease called sickle cell anemia, where they don't have the property of synthesizing sufficient hemoglobin in their bodies to fill out the blood cells. And there's another one, hemoglobin C, which mixed with S occurs in disease known as thalassemia, where they have a similar sort of deficiency. Now, if I may have these next 2 slides, it's been discovered just very recently that by applying these same techniques, this is a paper from Chromatograph, left one hemoglobin A, this one here, hemoglobin S, C and E. The S one I want you to fix attention on. If you compare here the patterns 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5, an ordinary hemoglobin, you see, if you can look here, 1, 2, 3, 5, 4 is displaced. So these move because in the same direction, because they are the same substances. So if this one is different, it means that this hemoglobin has a different amino acid. And if I can have the next slide, please. This is the difference here. There's hemoglobin A. It has that sequence there, valine, histamine, leucine, threonine, proline, glutamine. But here, instead of having glutamine, you've got valine, and here, this one, lysine. Now, the reason these are different, as now thought, is because the gene in the body that is synthesizing the desoxyribonucleic acid, which gave this sequence of amino acids, something happened to it at one point. There was a mutation. Somewhere in time, the person had been subject to cosmic ray radiation or some such damage, and his desoxyribonucleic acid goes wrong at this point. Instead of synthesizing when it gets the glutamine, it synthesizes this compound, valine, pushes this in the chain, and then goes off. And this person goes wrong here. So this is why these people have this inherited disease. They can't help themselves. It's there in their genes, and it can never be altered. And until they die, they'll continue to make this hemoglobin S, unless some way is found of changing this. Now, the importance of this sort of thing is really cannot be overemphasized, because we know that now that these mutations do help this. One of the things we might project into the future is that there will be an increasing recognition of the importance of this type of work in studying diseases which up to this time have not been recognized as being inherent in this particular fashion. There's absolutely no use of trying to feed this man with various medicines. There are just nothing one can do about genetic disease of this type. There are, however, other things which are important to us, and that is this, that we should be careful not to cause such mutations ourselves. Now, this gets one into a terrific political problem, and I'm not here to talk about politics. All I'm here to say is that if one causes mutation by any technique at your disposal, you tend to upset the genetic pattern which is there, and it might be a beneficial thing, but on the other hand, it might not. And so it's easy to predict that, one, that there will be tremendous discoveries to be made in medicine and in chemotherapy to understand the nature of protein diseases, shall we call them, and this will enable us to have a more intelligent approach to these things. Now, the next area I want to pass on is one which is a little less intense to us, and it's the subject of photosynthesis. And I want to talk about this because it has, besides being interesting in itself and a puzzle to mankind for a long while, how plants were able to assimilate carbon dioxide and water and form all the interesting substances that they do form, such as sugars and starches and so forth, that we eventually eat in the form of wheat and other products, and also how they produce such beautiful colors and such nice foliage. And we've all the time been concerned as interested human beings to how the plant did this so efficiently when we have not yet been able to do this by any other means. Now, photosynthesis has been studied, of course, for a long while, and there have been very many theories and many, many people interested in trying to explain it. But again, as is so often the case, happy developments in other fields lead to new techniques. Now, I don't want to pass over this too quickly and not give enough credit to all the important people who made magnificent discoveries which led to ideas and patterns of thought which enabled future scientists make their advances. But I want to spend a little time on one particular technique because it has been so very important in the last 5 or 10 years, and also to here make one or two suggestions of how this might be useful to us in the world we live in today and in the future. May I have the first slide, please? Photosynthesis consists of just taking The plant symbol is carbon dioxide and water, and with light, which is represented by this, forms this type of grouping, which is the basis of all sugars. May I have the next one, please? This is represented, oh, also, the water here broken up by light and chlorophyll. I put this little leaf on there to note chlorophyll. Some people told me it should have been a shamrock, and I see that they have actually colored it. It's thought that this breaks the water up into hydrogen and an active form of oxygen hydroxyl, and we eventually get out oxygen here and a sugar form here. Can I have the next slide, please? Now, that's the very simple form. Actually, in the plant, a tremendous number of other things go on. The CO2, this is a cycle. Could it be focused a little more, please? No, I'm sorry. The same slide back. That's closed. The carbon dioxide comes in here. Light shines on the coloring matter of plants, the green coloring matter, chlorophyll, and somewhere or other, the chlorophyll can cause the carbon dioxide in the water to form the various products that we find in plants, very complex ones. They're labeled here as hexoses, heptoses, etc., etc., right on to form sucrose and various starches. It forms proteins and other things like that, and various other products that we know that come from plants, such as glycerin and so forth. And this is called the photosynthetic cycle. It's a very complex thing. Now, just recently, due to the introduction of an isotope of carbon which is radioactive, scientists have been able to use radioactive carbon dioxide and follow through these paths in considerable detail using the radioactivity of the carbon to trace out the way in which it's built up into all these different substances. Could I have the next slide, please? This, I'm sorry, the next one after this, please. I'll have that one back again, yes. This has led to ideas as to how the water and the carbon dioxide might be built up in very complex cycles of this sort. And the nature of these have been worked out in considerable detail. That's very clear now, the actual pathways by which carbon dioxide and water are turned into the various plant products. However, what is yet a great mystery is how, by taking light from sunlight, the chlorophyll, the green coloring matter, is able to do all of this. Now, one suggestion is that the light is somewhere or other, the energy from the light is transferred by the chlorophyll into chemical energy. And just how it does is a complete mystery, because it does it so very efficiently. And recently, it's become important to know how this happens, because we've become interested in space flight and leaving this Earth and going to all sorts of places, Venus and all other places. And, of course, in outer space, there's a tremendous amount of sunlight. And so there's a great interest in developing what's called solar batteries. Some weeks ago, Dean Mars talked to you about semiconductors and how they might be used. But there is a thought in the back of a number of people's minds that possibly we might copy the plants and find out our chlorophyll utilizes radiant energy, and possibly if we knew that, we might be in a position to develop better ways of utilizing sunlight and so using solar batteries. One thought is that, of course, one might be able to use this method here for providing food and sustenance for the people who are in these spaceships. There are known little tiny algae called chlorella, which can photosynthesize sugars and other things very efficiently. So one could imagine one having a little photosynthetic factory in a rocket or space capsule and using the sunlight to provide one's sugar and things like this while one is going through the space for several years before one reaches a planet or something of this sort. And this has seriously been suggested. Could we pass on to the next one, please? I've got this out. But I'll come back to that point later. Recently, there's been a tremendous development in this, because the coloring matter itself, chlorophyll, has actually been synthesized by a chemist. Professor Woodward and his group at Harvard did this. Very important chemical advancement. And this is going to lead to tremendous developments in this whole area of study. This is the complex molecule here, which has been synthesized. And having this available now, knowing its structure accurately, will enable chemists to go ahead and develop in great detail a number of similar systems and possibly understand how this molecule in fact does its work. May I go back to the next slide, the slide you had on the board, please? That's right. One suggestion is that the electrons in the chlorophyll are interrupted in their motions by the sunlight and caused to execute rather different paths like this. Instead of one being in this area, one is here. They have different properties in those conditions. They are what we call, in this particular venture, let's call an excited state. But they can also be changed from that into another state where they have the property that their relation to each other by virtue of their intrinsic spin motion is in a certain fashion free. And we know that this is an important thing now because all the fluorescent materials seem to be excited to this type of state and then give out their energy by coming back to the original condition they were in. There's been a considerable amount of interest in this type of thing because it's thought that this may be the way in which chlorophyll does utilize solar energy. And within recent times, there have been quite definitive evidence that this type of system here is in fact not very far from the truth. May I have the next slide, please? This is a diagram of the plant inside the chloroplast where it does utilize the sunlight. And recently, scientists have been trying to copy this to see if they can, in fact, cause the utilization of radiant energy more efficiently. They've been preparing this type of system, so-called, we tend to call them charge transfer complexes. I'll skip the next slide, please, and have the one up. No, skip that one, please. Next one. Yes. And it's undoubtedly true that quite soon there will be developments using materials based on these ideas which will enable us to utilize radiant energy much more efficiently than we have been doing up to the present time. But there's another way in which photosynthesis can help us. That is this, that one of the problems when you're in this capsule going off to Venus or Mars is the fact that when you exhale, you exhale carbon dioxide, you use the oxygen you breathe in. And if you go on doing this, of course, you begin to become asphyxiated in your own carbon dioxide. So the problem is, how will this be dealt with? And one quite serious suggestion is this, that if you have plants or chlorella or any of these algae, they will use up the carbon dioxide, you see, and photosynthesize and make you this chlorophyll breakfast, and then give you out oxygen. And when you breathe in the oxygen for your own metabolism and breathe out the carbon dioxide, they'll go on doing that. So you have two cycles, a photosynthetic cycle and a respiration cycle. And this has quite seriously been suggested as a means whereby this might be quite important to us in our travels through outer space. And who are we to disagree with such suggestions? May I have the next slide, please? Is that the last one? Yes, thank you. May I have the lights, please? Oh, sorry. See, we have no small chemistry boys here. Well, there's one thing that's going to be important, but there are other reasons for us being interested in photosynthesis. One of the big problems facing mankind at the present time is the fact that if the population of the world goes on increasing at its present rate, someone has calculated that by the year 2026, there will just be enough room for all of us to stand up on the Earth. Now, if that's to be the case, there are several problems. One is we have to produce much more food than we now are doing to feed the population. And the other one is we might do something about controlling it. But it is seriously suggested by a great number of scientists, and I think you'll hear more about this from Sir Charles Darwin when he comes, later next month, that a possible way of providing foodstuffs is to make more efficient use of photosynthetic techniques on an industrial scale. And in fact, there are various laboratories in the world where this is being attempted today. It is just conceivable that in the next 10 years, quite a number of elemental foodstuffs will be provided by this method going on in very large industrial factories. And it doesn't take, as I say, much imagination to suggest that to you. I think it will come about very soon. Well, I've covered these areas very quickly, and I want to end up with one or two thoughts on other things. I have a note here about hormones and vitamins. Every time I see the word hormone nowadays, I think of the pictures I see in the New Yorker, which I read religiously each week because I used to have to get jokes from my freshmen. And there's always a picture of a person whom I take now to be a distinguished scientist, Miss Helena Rubinstein, and she's always dealing with hormones. Now, these substances do have a tremendous effect on our body, and I'm not going into these things now. You all know how you can turn a cockerel into a diligent little hen by feeding it certain chemical hormones and vice versa, and we can cause sea urchins' eggs to fertilize without the male by doing similar tricks. And you all have used 2,4-D in your gardens to kill off dandelions and other things. Those are plant hormones. Well, with the development that I mentioned, ATCH, a few moments ago, the synthesis of those, and similar developments in what we call steroid chemistry, it's pretty obvious that the hormone field is entering a new era. And intimately connected to this is the problem of cancer. There are a great number of cancers which are known to be respond favorably to some of these materials. And it's pretty easy to guess that in the next 10 or 20 years, many of the cancers which afflict females will be curable, and many of skin cancers also. It's also easy to suggest in the next 25 years that a number of cancers that are peculiar to males will be curable by similar techniques. I don't think that's going out on a limb at all. I think that this is easily foreseeable by these enormous developments and the understanding of the ways these act, and then the tremendous developments have been made in chemical syntheses. This raises other problems. We're all the time increasing mankind's length of life. Longevity is now no longer a joke with us. And it raises other problems. Are we to continue to just advance our average lifespan without doing anything about the other things that happen to us? This is why I made that mention about Miss Rubinstein. I don't think myself that that's at all facetious. I think that if we are going to live to be 100, 120, or even 150, which is possible, possibly, in the next 25 or 50 years, more and more people will be reaching well over the century. Do we want them to become decrepit, wrinkled old beings? Why not have the flourished and interest of youth still? And this, surely, is something which one could easily say will come about, that there will be means found to preserve our bodily functions by chemical substances, by hormones, which will be more fully understood then. It might be that it will come quite sooner. After all, there have been discovered recently various plant hormones such as gibberellic acid, which enable us to grow potatoes the size of melons without any difficulty. I'm not suggesting we want to grow bigger. I'm only suggesting that some of the attractive ladies I see here, when I meet them 60 years hence, they'll be equally attractive. I think I will end on that note.
Ladies and gentlemen, I see a number of people here who are qualified to ask questions, and perhaps those that are qualified should first ask the questions. And while they're preparing their questions, we'll get the unqualified questions. Yes, sir.
If I might ask, question. I'm one of the unqualified ones. I understand that science has been delving into the possibilities of actually changing the genes in the bloodstream. Now, I understand the genes have something to do with the hereditary traits that come into the life of an individual, and by changing those genes, they can eliminate undesirable traits in the person's character. I don't know much more about it.
Well, what you say is quite right, that the genes do control the heritable traits, and sometimes we all wish we could do something about it. It's not quite as simple as that. I think it's true to say that there's no known way of changing what we call bad genes into good genes, but there are quite a number of ways of changing good genes into bad genes. You've only got to go down to Granville Street and try to buy yourself a pair of shoes in one of these shops where they'll x-ray and show that the shoe pinches, and you've immediately got yourself a dose of bad genes. So it's one of these irreversible things, as we say in science. You can go from good to bad, but there's no known way yet of going from bad to good. The only way is to just stop having progeny, and then those bad genes die out. But the other process isn't quite as easy.
Would you like to say a word about these x-ray machines down there?
No.
Radiation. Skip that one. Well, ladies and gentlemen, if there are more questions, I'd like to ask Professor Forward, the head of our Department of Mining and Metallurgy, to thank our speaker on our behalf tonight.
Chairman, ladies and gentlemen, it's a singular pleasure for me tonight to say a few words at this time. I'm although a metallurgist, I'm just a chemist at heart, and I can sympathize with a lot of things that Dr. Dow has talked about and take a great deal of interest in. I noticed he rather dodged the metals tonight. I'm not just sure why, but we get into hormones and photosynthesis and a variety of other general aspects of chemistry. But he didn't say very much about the metals. And there are interesting areas that are growing there, areas in which the inorganic field that is tremendously exciting and that will grow along with all these others. I was a little worried occasionally some years ago, as a good many of you have done. I read Brave New World. Reading it again lately, also catching up with Huxley and reading Brave New World Revisited. I just wonder whether some of these predictions that Dr. McDowell makes, how soon they're going to come. It's all very well to look at them and say, perhaps be in the position of the man who was at a lecture, and the lecturer was talking about some things that were going to happen in the future. And he said that if the energy position of the world, the world is gradually running down, we're always losing energy, we never gain any new energy, except perhaps a little bit that come from outer space, but it's gradually running down. And he said, if this process continues, that within, he said, the Earth ultimately will become as cold as the moon, no life, nothing at all left. He said, that will happen, according to our calculations, in about 70 million years. Somebody at the back of the hall said, pardon me, sir, he said, did you say 70 million years? And he said, yes, about 70 million is the best calculation we make. He said, why did you ask? Well, he said, I was just afraid. I thought you said 7 million. I'm not too sure. Some of these things that people think of